start the House Interim Special Task Force on PERS Sustainability and Accountability. It is August 7th, and we're going to start with Jim Boyko and a PERS history overview, and that overview is on the board. Is that available to, are copies of that available on the desk back there?
There were some.
Used up. Maybe we want to, I don't know. Okay. But Jim, whenever you're ready, go ahead and start and take us through the timeline history that we have before us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're pleased to distribute this morning a memorandum going over some of the history of the PERS statute. It follows our construction of the timeline for the statute, and I was struggling this morning to try to make some sense in my remarks to you about what we take away anyway from both the graphic that you have in front of you as well as the memorandum on the historical development of the statute. And I thought rather than sort of go through it chronologically year by year, if you don't mind, I'd like to present some themes that I draw out of the statute and the history that the staff has put together for us. And because I think that the lessons are not in the year by year, but the lessons are in what the clumps of the themes that have emerged, if I could. And those themes are multiple structures, competing underlying concepts, division and redivision of the membership base, steady increases in the value of the plan, at least until the institution of Tier 2, and a few closing comments about my observations about how the staff and myself and our board of directors works with the statute, if that would be helpful to you in terms of understanding the instructions that you as the legislature have given to us. The first thing on multiple structures, as you read through the statute and the chronological history, one of the things that strikes you is that our state has gone back and forth between the plan structure that it seems to want as the underlying vehicle for providing pension benefits to public employees. Let me just recount some of the plan structures. Many of them, most of them, are still in effect today because few of them have been sunset completely. The first one, as the statutory history, the memorandum that we have handed out, is a traditional DC plan. That was the original money match structure, was a defined contribution plan where the obligation was to put money into an account and it produced investment returns, which then provided a benefit. Later, however, construction was added to the statute, another pension structure, if you will, which we would call a hybrid structure, the pension plus annuity, where on one side of the hybrid there was a traditional defined benefit structure, the pension part, and the other part, the annuity part, was more like a defined contribution. So there was a second structure added to the statute. Third structure was added then, and that was a defined contribution base but with an embedded return guarantee, and that was the development or the movement of the Tier 1 structure, Tier 1 money match structure, with the addition of the guarantee, which fundamentally changed its nature. It was no longer strictly a DC plan. It was a DC plan with a return guarantee. Then there was a fourth structure added, which the staff refers to as defined benefit with contributory features, is the term that's used in the textbook, and that's the full formula structure. It is more like a defined benefit structure, driven from final average salary and years of service, but it does use account-based techniques to create account values, which are then used for things like refunds. So it's not really a totally pure defined benefit structure. Then there was a fifth structure added over time, and that was a DC-based structure again, but this time with an embedded guarantee that rather than being a rate of return guarantee was a benefit floor provided by the full formula methodology itself, and of course I'm referring to Tier 2. So it wasn't really a pure DC plan, nor was it a pure DB plan. It was, and in fact it wasn't even a textbook hybrid plan. Then, and I'm not going chronologically now, there's a sixth structure that's embedded in the statute, and that is a very traditional DC-oriented plan, and that, of course, is the variable account, which is a contributory based plan, which whose returns are strictly market-driven. And then I would point out that while none of them have passed, the legislature has considered several proposals in the past several regular sessions for a Tier 3, and if my memory serves me correctly, those were a return to the hybrid pension plus annuity structure. So the point I would make to you from this is that our state has not settled on the structure that it seems to want to consistently apply to provide adequate pension coverage to public employees, but in fact has moved from structure to structure over time. Most of these structures are all still active, or many of them are still active, and embedded in the statute as we go forward, which is one of the reasons why we have a statute that runs to 76 pages and 64,000 words. And sometimes we run into clashes between these methodologies. It also adds to administrative burden because, of course, the statute instructs us that we're to provide we're to use the methodology that provides the highest benefit to members. And so at a minimum, we always have to do at least two calculations at time of retirement for every member. And throughout the member's career, we have to keep, in essence, two slightly different sets of data to allow us to make those calculations when that member shows up for retirement. If I could move on to the second concept, which is or the second theme that I draw from these histories, and that is that that when you have multiple structures, you inevitably produce competing underlying concepts. And this is one of the things that has troubled us, and if we discuss, as I understand is on your agenda, sequential versus equal crediting, you'll get a sense of exactly this problem that I'm about to talk about in a real live sense in the statute. What I mean by this is that some parts of the statute are very much like a mutual fund. The variable account, for example, it's individually based. The board is instructed to put financial returns as traditionally determined in the financial marketplace and apply them to those particular account bases. And it's pretty straightforward in many senses. It's very, very similar to what a mutual fund accounting structure might look like. On the other hand, something like Tier 2, which is also account-based, has a very lengthy array, or Tier 1, I should say, but also Tier 2, a very lengthy array of provisions that instruct us as to how we're to assign returns or credit interest, as the statute says, to those accounts that are that have no counterpart in traditional mutual fund type fund accounting. And then we also have concepts that are not like account-based ones at all. The full formula, for example, while it does have some account-based features, is much more like a traditional pension program where you're tracking creditable service and people's salaries, but not dollar-based metrics, if you will.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. A question for Mr. Voitko. Jim, when you say that this has no equal or has no this crediting methodology has there's nothing similar to it in mutual funds, other types of funds out there. Is there this kind of a modified program for other retirement programs in the United States somewhere?
There are, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, there are a few other programs. We've been doing, obviously, some research on this. Colorado is an example, and one of the plans in Washington State have what are called return guarantees. They operate something like Tier 1, but with some very significant differences. For example, I believe the one in Washington is a career guarantee, not an annual one. And if you read some of the letters that I've written to questions that Senator Nelson has posed, annual versus career is a big difference. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that we have the structures in the statute, like the gain loss reserve, is to try to cope with the fact that this is an annual process. One of your colleagues in the House of Representatives, Representative Schrader, has asked me about the annual nature of this and has actually posed the question does it have to be annual? And we think that the statute instructs us to do it annually. In fact, we're pretty clear about that. So that's one difference. The other difference is that the plan that was recently put into Colorado and the one in Washington, I believe, do not set at equal levels the assumed rate to the guaranteed rate. I believe in one plan, I believe it's Colorado, there's a 20% discount, so that there's a gap between what is guaranteed, the floor, and what the plan expects to earn. And that also is a significant difference. But we could do a comparison of the two. They're generally, these return-based guarantees are generally unusual and not the norm, but there are a few other states other than Oregon that that do utilize them, albeit in a different, in a significant different way.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Would it be fair to say then that as to Oregon State employees, the PERS is perhaps one of the richest programs so far as rewarding employees in the United States?
Chair Knopp, or Knopp, Representative Beller, richest is a term that I'd rather steer away from because if you mean does it produce higher benefits at the end of the day than many others, we've done some preliminary research on that, and we believe that the Oregon system would probably be certainly in the top 10%, but we haven't pinned it down exactly. And it also depends on what period you're examining, but certainly currently, I suspect that would be true. But whether or not that's perceived as rich or inadequate is really something between labor and management, not for the pension administrator to say.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to haggle over whether $10 is more than $9. My sense is, from where you're coming from, Jim, is that we're paying out more at retirement under the current formula than any other state to any other state employee. And I would think that's just a matter of taking a look at the bottom line, how many dollars they're getting in retirement when they retire in 2002 versus in Oregon versus in Colorado or Washington or any other of the 47 states in the union.
Representative Butler, as I said, I believe that if we were to do that analysis to completion to our satisfaction of quality, we would probably see Oregon PERS being one of the systems that's currently producing high benefits relative to the average in the nation. I suspect that would be true. But keep in mind that whether that's high or low, it is what the system is producing. I don't want to characterize it as rich or poor, adequate or inadequate.
Mr. Chair, as much as we're going to haggle over terminology here, I would then have you not use the word produce. I would have you use the word pay out, because we are not producing that kind of returns, I don't believe, Jim.
In terms of investment returns, Representative Butler, that clearly is the case right now. Otherwise, we wouldn't be generating as large a UAL. I will also say that we are in the midst and very close to, within 2 weeks or so, of producing a much more definitive what we call replacement ratio analysis. As you recall, in the last general session, the legislature asked us quickly to say what in recent times were pension benefits as they related to final average salary, and those numbers got some play. We're going back and redoing that analysis, but at a much deeper level so that we can actually give you the hows and whys and wherefores and for what types of individuals and circumstances produce final benefits that equal or exceed final average salary. We'll also compare it with and without Social Security. We'll do every kind of analysis, and it's very close to completion, and we'd be happy to provide it to all of you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The third thing that I wanted to mention, Chairman Knopp, was that there is, over time, over the 50-plus years that the statute has been in existence and revised and re-revised, there has been a progressive division and redivision of the membership base with different rules applying. Let me just give you 12 examples, and I could give you many more, of categories of members for which some special rules apply, sometimes many special rules. First of all, of course, there's general service and police and fire. There's teachers, legislators, judges, wildland firefighters, members who joined pre-1981 to whom pension and annuity applies, and those post-1981 to whom it doesn't apply. Those members who joined post-1996, for which, who received Tier 2 membership rights, those that were employed pre-1996 who get Tier 1. We have special rules for ex-military individuals. We have special rules for Forest Service individuals in terms of their ability to buy service credits. We have different treatment for those people who were employed prior to 1999 and post-1999 in terms of the mortality tables we use in calculating and annuitizing their accounts. And we also have certain provisions that apply to retired teachers in rural counties. So over time, I think all for good reasons, I'm presuming, the legislature has taken sections of the membership base and applied special rules to them. That's another reason why the statute has become as long as it is, and we have treatment of individuals within the membership base that is highly specific to their job function, characteristics, date of hire, and so on. So our membership base has become progressively subdivided over time. I think that's one of the themes that clearly comes out of the history of the statute. The fourth theme, it's one that I think reflects something that's generally true in public pension plans across the United States, and that is until the institution of Tier 2, there seemed to be a pretty steady increase in what one would perceive as the value of the plan. And let me give some metrics or some measures that come out of the history, particularly the memorandum that you have. The full formula factors, improvement in those. The institution of the Tier 1 guarantee, which clearly has substantial value. Progressively earlier retirement ages. Increases in retirement options. Increases in service purchase options. I think that it reflects both what the trends have been over the last four or five decades in public pension plans. It reflects a wealthier society that we live in. And it also reflects progressive agreements that have been reached between management and labor over time that have been reflected by the legislature in statute. So that's the fourth theme I mentioned. The fifth one is something that came up when I was asked to comment on some proposed legislation in the last special session before Senator Farioli's committee and the other body. And what I mentioned in that is that when you look at the statute, it is remarkable for a statute of its length how few definitions there are. For example, a very topical issue, mortality tables and what is actuarially equivalent. The statute has never said. We did a review of the statute, and the term actuarially equivalent is strewn throughout the statute, but it's nowhere defined. So exactly what it means and exactly what mortality table policy, for example, underlies it is unclear. And that holds true at the policy level, too. Mortality table policy is not set out in statute. It's not even hinted at unless one reads into phrases like the sound and efficient administration of the system or fiduciary duty or something like that, which that's one of the reasons that the PERS board is wrestling with having such difficulty, I believe, wrestling with this issue. But that's also true in terms of reserving policy. It wasn't until the 55th year of the statute, that is the last regular session, that the legislature gave the board an indication of what goal it wanted the board to pursue when it used its general reserving policy. And that policy goal that was set out in SB 134, that is that the board should try to avoid incurring deficits in the Tier 1 portion of the system, was the first time the board had any indication of what the legislature wanted it to do with the powers that had been put in the statute. One of the other things that I mentioned when I testified in the last special session is there's no delineation in the statute and the statute, by the way, is our plan document. For legal purposes, for IRS purposes, it is the plan, the statute is. And there's no delineation. The legislature has never distinguished in the statute explicitly what is a long-term and relatively immutable contract agreement with public employees in the state of Oregon. And those things that, in fact, as one member joins the system, should expect to be changed over time according to some rational process or consideration laid out. So this has presented to the courts a plan document that does not differentiate between those things that the legislature said were explicit contractual promises and those things that weren't. So one could argue that then that decision as to what is and isn't has been forfeited to the courts. And yet, at the same time, despite the fact that there are few definitions, relatively few policy directions, and no delineation about what's in the promise and what's not, what's in the contract and what's not, or what members should expect to change over time, yet there are many quite explicit specifics, for example, about, for example, we'll see this afternoon, the crediting of earnings, highly specific. When it should happen, what order it should happen, who it should happen to, and to what degree. So those, as I read both the graphic history of the statute and the history that our staff wrote that you have before you, those are the themes that I would bring back to you, and particularly to those who criticize the PERS board and the staff, and I hope I'm not being defensive here, for seeming to have difficulty getting our arms around what the statute requires us to do. I will repeat what I've said in testimony previously, that we spend an enormous amount of our time trying with all our hearts and souls to figure out what the legislature is asking us to do in the statute. So I'll stop there, and I'll be happy to answer questions. I know you have a full day's agenda in front of you.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Just to make sure that the legislature has asked the board to do some very specific things, and I understand you'll be doing those out of special session three, that the board will be taking up some of those special things, and I hope they do come to some conclusions as to the discussions or as to the requests of the Legislative Assembly.
I can assure you the board is working overtime on this issue. In fact, Representative Butler, this month, the board has not scheduled its regular monthly meeting. It's scheduled two meetings. So I think that the board is certainly doing its best efforts to respond to the legislature.
Mr. Chair, I just say that sometimes in times of crisis, we have to open up more than one exit to a building.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Jim, during the, I think it was the third special session, I've lost count, but I think it was the third. I think four and five are going to be upon us soon. But anyway, there was a bill that I don't believe did pass, but talked about directing the PERS agency to come up with potential successor systems, one of those being a defined contribution, but clearly we were looking for several. And even though that bill didn't pass, I would request on behalf of the speaker that we ask you to do that and provide us with those possibilities to look at a future meeting. I know that'll take a little bit of time to put together, but I am requesting that, and I wanted to put that on the record.
Chair Canope, could I ask a clarifying question?
Yes, you can.
Without specific objectives that we're supposed to target, it would be our preference to come back to you with an array of structures that touch on all the objectives that we could think of, because we don't want to be put in a position of by our choice of structure telling the legislature, or subtly, indirectly, or directly, what objectives matter and what don't. So if it could be encompassed within your instruction to provide an array, that would be, I think, very helpful to us.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. We'd like to see several different options as to the potential, and you can talk. Obviously, it's a policy decision if there needs to be a successor system, and we'll take that up. But we'd like to see what you guys would come up with in regards to those possibilities. So I wouldn't put any parameters on what you might come up with, but we are interested in having some professionals take a look at it and get back to us on it.
We'd be happy to do so.
Any other questions for Mr. Voico while he's here this morning? I understand you're coming back this afternoon for a fun roundtable session and answering questions and so on. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are going to welcome our newest member, Representative King. Thank you for gracing us with your presence today. We were hoping that you would come and give us a quorum, even though we're not voting on anything, but thank you for coming. We're going to go ahead and call up, well, let's see, is it Mary? Mary, are you on deck? Mary Botkin? We'll have some employee representatives, and Mary sounds like maybe she's the person, to talk about the issues and perspectives as it relates to PERS and give us their take on it.
Mr. Chair.
And if you would like to bring...
We've kind of divided this up into little pieces.
Oh, much better for the chair. Thank you.
Okay.
So you guys...
So there'll be more of us than just me.
Yeah.
But each one, we're going to try not to be repetitious.
Great.
So just bear with us if we are, but we're trying not to be. So each one of us has a different area, and my area is kind of the historical perspective, if you will, and displacing some of the sort of myths that are, the urban myths that are out there about PERS. First of all, can we just like go back in time? Because originally, Oregon's money, including its retirement money, was very poorly invested. And there wasn't any kind of state policy about how we were going to invest funds or how those funds should be utilized in a productive manner.
Mary, how far back have we gone?
We have gone back to roughly 1967 when the Oregon Investment Council, from what I can find out, was first established under Bob Straub, and then later kind of modernized a little bit under Jim Redden. And the really major changes occurred, from what we can find out, under Clay Myers. And Treasurer Myers really moved the whole investment idea into kind of the 20th century, if you will, and really started linking Oregon's investments to the stock market. And from the timeline that we have, it looks like about that time when we first started looking at assumed interest rates and started moving assumed returns on investments into a more linked reality with what the stock market was actually returning. And I've been trying to overlay it with this, and I'm just going to proceed, okay?
Mary, could you just give us your name and...
I'm sorry. Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75 and the PERS Coalition. Anyway, so what you had was you had a movement to modernize how we handled states' investments and states' money, because up until then, our money's been kind of sitting around drawing interest, but not much. And so Clay Myers really moved that into a more aggressive format. And with that, he also encouraged people to participate in the variable account, because that gave an opportunity for employees to participate in the economy. And it also gave the Oregon Investment Council the ability to invest funds into a little more risky area, and the employees knew sort of what the risks were that they were taking. And that remains today, that if you're in the variable account, you get partially what the stock market returns, or you lose what the stock market loses of your variable funds. And, you know, that is an employee option. And as of last session, we fixed it so that the employers can mirror and keep track or keep up with the employee options by doing the same thing that the employee chooses to do. One of the other kind of myths that we're hearing now a lot about is the early retirement programs. The early retirement programs were not something that we brought to the table. They certainly were something we were willing to look at once they were on the table, and I was trying to go back and figure out when we first started looking at this, and I think it's been about 12 or 13 years ago that we really started examining a lot of buyouts and early retirement programs for current employees. Let's be clear, The early retirement plans were brought to us first by the school districts as a way to move in new teachers and a way to move out kind of the older tenured teachers as a way to revitalize the workforce. And I think that was done in virtually all of our employer operations, was that new early retirement plans were looked at a way that you could take people who are at the top of the scale out in a constructive manner, bring in a newer, younger workforce, which certainly was not something that the unions were opposed to, but were something that we wanted to be sure handled the folks who'd served a career properly. And, you know, so it wasn't just us that wanted an early retirement plan, but rather it was some of our, quote, industry folks who wanted it for the same reasons that the private sector industry wants it. Sick leave, the sick leave rollovers or the sick leave buy-ins or whatever you want to call them, the crediting people with sick leave, that was another employer program that was brought to us as a way to eliminate the use of sick leave in the workforce. And it was an incentive to encourage people to save their sick leave till retirement and not utilize it in an unplanned manner. Again, not something we brought to the table, and in fact, when we finally agreed to utilizing 50% of the sick leave for enhanced retirement benefits, most of us took a significant amount of pressure from our members that we had, quote, sold them out and sold out their sick leave benefits, and that now they were going to lose 50% of their sick leave benefit, and why shouldn't they just burn it off? And we did it as a way of saying, look, folks, this is a better way to do it. It's a way to have you leave the workforce at retirement without burning out 2.5 months at the end of your career, where there's no really good planned transition for your employer. Because what we were finding was is that, you know, we have the great story of the backhoe operator up in the Multnomah County area that had been doing this backhoe operation for, you know, 25 years, knew where all the lines were, knew where all the utility lines were, got ready to retire, had 2.5 months worth of sick leave on the books, got a doctor's excuse and burned off 2.5 months worth of sick leave, leaving the employer with nobody to transition the new backhoe operator into the position. It made no sense to us. It was a way to reward employees for not burning up sick leave and at the same time reward, you know, help the employer with a transition process. Employer rates, you know, it's interesting that we keep hearing about benefit increases, and, you know, we have this wonderful timeline of all the benefit increases, mm-hmm. but we don't have an equal timeline of employer rates. And, you know, I've been searching through my three file drawers of files trying to find a coherent employer rate process that I could bring to you. But as I recall, up until the last few years, employer rates were on the decline, not on the increase. And we've heard very little about the decline in employer rates and a lot about the increases in employer rates. And I would challenge the agency and the employers to come back with some kind of a timeline that shows what their rates were. Because when we increased assumed interest rates to the current 8%, employer rates didn't go up, they went down. When we increased them from 7% to 7.5%, employer rates didn't go up, they went down.
Question.
Representative Smith.
Yes, if I may interrupt, Ms. Botkin. Is that because of increase in the earnings in the stock market?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we don't have those increased earnings in the stock market. Who's left to play? Employers.
Well, I mean, I think that you have to look at both sides, though. We have to look at, in all fairness, as we examine the system, you have to look not just at the increases, but at the decreases as well.
That's fine. Thank you. That timeline would be interesting.
Yeah. Okay, and I'm not going to take much more time from the committee. I just want to say that historically, the PERS Coalition has shared with the employers their concern over a system that at times was too lean for the employees, and have tried to act in a responsible manner with the information we had in front of us at that moment, just as you as legislators have. And to kind of go back and say, gee, we made bad decisions, says that the information that we had in front of us at the time was bad. I don't know that it was bad. I don't know that anybody knows that it was bad. I know that very careful, deliberative decisions were made based on the information that the agency brought to us as coalition members and as legislators to make decisions that we thought made sense for the system, for the employees, and for the employers. We understand that the system has to live beyond us. And, you know, I think that it's important to remember that there's a lot of history here, and that as we move through this process, it's sometimes good to look at all the history, not just at the inflammatory history that looks like the employees have been the only ones to make a buck out of this, because they haven't been. Ask the folks who work at Pioneer Square. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mary?
Pioneer Square was built with PERS funds. And it would be very interesting to have before you all of the jobs opportunities that PERS investments have made available to Oregonians separate and apart from public employment.
Mary, one thing that you didn't add that I found out in another forum, and a question I'll ask you is, have you ever been a member of PERS?
No. No, I'm not a member of PERS, unfortunately. I'm in a 401k. And as I looked at my 401k the other day, I realized that in the last 60 days, I have lost $47,000. So, you know, don't sign me up for a 401k program for my members.
You haven't lost anything if you haven't sold.
That's true.
It's only on paper.
Well, and we could say the same thing, sir, with all due respect, about the PERS system.
You could.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Peppers. I'm Assistant Executive Director with SEAU Local 503 OPEU. And just also get it out on the record, I'm not a PERS member, or never have been either, just like Mary. But we do represent a lot of people who are in the PERS system. And so my task here today is simply to lay out some general guidelines with which we're approaching this discussion for the committee. That's very general, and I just wanted to get this out there. I think Mary has actually touched on some of this. There's a lot of history here. And so one of our guidelines as we engage in this discussion is to recognize the historic trade-offs that have happened between aspects of the PERS and the pension system generally, but also between the pension system and other parts of compensation packages. There are implicit and explicit trade-offs that have occurred in the past that have been established both in union contracts as well as through the contract right that's established through the courts that we are very sensitive to. And when you're talking about people's pensions, obviously, it's a very big deal, and just as much as it's a very big deal when you're talking about in public budgets. So we want to recognize both sides of that. But one of the important things for us as we approach this is that there is a history here. Mary has given you many examples of some of that history and how it evolved, but we believe that that history has been established over time for good reasons. Many of the changes that were made very deliberately, and if we want to reevaluate them now and look back at some of those changes that were made, we think that's legitimate to do, but we also need to recognize that those changes were made cognizant of, at the time anyway, of the environment and goals that were being attempted to be achieved. And one of the things that we think has to be borne in mind is the role the pension system plays in recruitment and retention for public employees generally, and in many cases very specifically. So the whole thing is is charged and has long-term implications, not just on budgets immediately, but also on what employers can do to maintain a long-term workforce, or on the other side, have a high turnover rate that doesn't help produce quality services for the clients and the public they serve. At the same time, we also recognize that the plan, the pension plan, the PERS system, is complex right now, and complexity is a problem. It does lead to either misreadings, or can lead to, it doesn't always, but it can lead to misreadings of conflicting statutes or conflicting rules. Complexity on its own is not always a problem, just because or the fact that complexity can be difficult to administer shouldn't be the only reason to reevaluate it. I think we want clarity as much as possible, but there are good reasons why we might have some different layers of some of the examples Jim Boyko just gave, some different treatments or different rules for different kinds of employee groups were established with some thought, and throwing that out in sort of a wholesale manner is that or any other of the variable treatments in the system would probably be a rash approach, and we would say that the approach to take should be one of caution rather than to jump to a conclusion that just because it's complex means it's also wrong or bad. Bearing that thought in mind, though, we also do recognize that generally where possible, we would like to simplify the rules and simplify and erase any contradictory guidelines that are in the system, because it makes sense to have clear instructions to your state agencies rather than confusing ones if you want clear rules to be followed. And we sign on with the goal of wanting long-term sustainability of the system. What I mentioned before is just are some aspects of how you get there. We think another aspect of it that may be higher up on the employer's list, though, is volatility of rates, contribution rates. You need, as a public employer, though we would agree to, you need to have some predictability and some ability to plan ahead. And that's something that hasn't always existed within the PERS system. I think some steps have been taken to try and make that easier, to get closer to that goal with pooling of local government employers that have had very volatile contribution rates. And pooling helps address that problem. But there may be other things that can be done. And so volatility of employer rates is an issue that we're prepared to grapple with as well. But as we, for us, the guidelines would be that we want to approach the system and changes carefully and recognize that there are many historic trade-offs that have occurred, and that in reevaluating some of the aspects of the system, we might be stepping into minefields. And that's my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. We'll just continue with the panel.
Mike, switching chicks.
Okay.
I feel like I'm shrinking. This chair, for some reason, is very low, and I couldn't even read my own notes. So I, part of that has to do with eyesight and age. But for the record, Brian DeLashman, I'm representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Oregon Nurses Association. So I'll put on a couple of hats when I'm doing the discussion. A lot of the points that you've heard so far talk about history, and I'm going to talk about a couple of those, but then I'm going to also transition to some specific things with police and fire, and also specifically to nurses that I wanted to talk about. Hopefully my presentation is not too scattered. I didn't realize that I would even be speaking until about 10 minutes after 9, so I was scribbling notes, so I've got, there's my presentation, and if I miss something, I may say, wait a minute. First, let me say that I am not a PERS employee. I was an employee of a local jurisdiction for approximately 2.5 years and was never vested back in my early days in Columbia County. Worked in the planning department. I was the assistant planning director and ultimately the planning director in Columbia County, and left there to seek my fame and fortune in Salem, and pulled out of the system. Let me make a couple of comments. You heard a little bit about PERS as a part of a whole compensation package. And I think that's a very important point. I know that the specific thrust of this group is to talk about PERS and whether the benefits are rich, not rich, poor. And again, going back to Mr. Boyko's comments, I mean, that's up for debate whether or not if you earn more than your final average salary, is that a rich benefit plan? And I would be interested in seeing the comparisons to other states. But in doing so, I think you also have to do a comparison of whether or not in those other states the salary or wages for the same job are comparable to Oregon, so that you can, in fact, look at the whole compensation package during the entire not only working life of that employee but also subsequent in retirement. I think that's a valid request. I don't know that the PERS staff can do that, but I think that's a part of any full evaluation of benefits. I wanted to talk a little bit about sick leave. I know it was touched upon, about sick leave's use in the final calculation under some of the methods, not under money match. Let me talk to you about a couple of examples. Mary talked about the employee who had some sick leave accumulated and decided to use it at the tail end, and the problem that causes for employers. We are well aware of that particular problem, and that's why we, in fact, joined with the employers when they wanted to use sick leave as a part of the calculation. No one is condoning the use of sick leave when somebody's not sick and it not being accumulated. And let me give an example that's very close to me. I know the PERS Coalition's heard this, but I'm very proud. My wife is a school teacher. She's taught 29 years. Next year will be her last year, 30 years. She has used 3 days of sick leave in 29 years because of not only her work ethic, but also the reality that her PERS benefit at the tail end will be enhanced under some of the calculations, not under money match, when she gets to the tail end. Now, she did the right thing, but it also saves the employer all the way along. Every day of sick leave that's used costs the employer the cost of a substitute teacher. It doesn't come out of her salary. It comes out of the school district's budget. Now, is that a win-win? Yes, it's a win-win. And the legislature, when they put that into the statute, thought about it, made the right decision. It was a logical decision, as you've heard from the previous two people. It was well thought out, and it was done for the right reason. Of course, at the tail end, does that enhance somebody's benefit? Yeah, it enhances somebody's benefit. So instead of getting 60%, 70%, or let's say even 80% of their final average salary, because they did that, it saved the school district money, their benefit at the tail end is enhanced. Well, does that mean that that's a rich program for them at the tail end? Well, my wife will be getting more money than she would have. Is she going to get more than 100% of her final average salary? No. But by some people's calculation, she'll be getting a rich retirement benefit. Let me give you another example. Her teaching aide, who's taught there 26 years, 59-year-old woman, wants to retire next year with my wife. She makes $16,000 a year after 26 years in the district. And she wanted to know what her benefit would be. So I went on the PERS website and said, okay, given all the things I know about this person, the age, what she has in her calculations right now, assumed earnings and everything else, what would her benefit be? Keep in mind, this person that's worked 26 years, been working 27 years, 59 years old, $16,000, been making $1,200 a month under PERS. Now, is that an excessive benefit? I would say no. And I think you're going to find, as you get the information about the benefits paid out, you'll find a lot more of those types of examples than you will the example of somebody who's making 105% or 110% or 120% of their final average salary. So I want us to keep this all in perspective. Are there some people that are making more than 100%? Yes. Is that rich? Representative Butler, you and I can debate whether that's a rich benefit or not, but there are factors that go into that, that if unless you look at those, which is accumulation of sick leave, utilization of that, they're going into the variable and taking risk that may lead to that richer benefit. Whereas if they wouldn't have done those things, their benefit would have been lower. And they took the risk or they made a decision that had an impact on what that benefit ultimately was. And let me transition into police and fire and nurses. I'm sorry I'm kind of going on. But as I have a discussion with my police officers and corrections officers about what's going on with PERS right now, there's obviously panic. I don't want to say panic in the streets, but they want to know what's going on. And one of the things that they come up with first is we live a shorter duration. The mortality for police, police and fire is a shorter lifespan than it is for general public, but yet we have one mortality table. And that's why the legislature decided that under the full formula, there would be a different calculation. Instead of 1.67, it would be 2.0 times the average of the highest, the final 3 years, times the years of service. So there is a recognition by the legislature that there's a differentiation for police and fire. I think that's very important as we go forward, that we keep those kinds of, you know, when you say we want to make a system simple, well, it's not always simple. There are some factors that you need to factor in, and this is an example, again, something the legislature did that made sense. We still think it makes sense, and so for any future design that you're looking at, I think there are different categories that require a different look than just putting all employees in any service into a lump and saying, okay, here's what the new plan is going to look like. The reality of that is that unless you do look at those kinds of factors, including in police and fire, you're well aware that they can retire after 25 years of service rather than 30 years of service. And the police officers that I work for chuckle when I use this example, but how many of you want a police officer 62 years old and still on the beat chasing down an 18-year-old who's just done a bank robbery or something else? There's reasons, there's dual reasons for this kind of a system. In fact, you do, as was talked about, bring in new, fresher folks, but you also, it's a recognition that 25 years eligibility for retirement is a recognition that their lifespan is shorter, therefore they're able to retire 5 years earlier. It's, you know, it's a shift of how much time they're going to be able to retire post-retirement before they finally die off. So, again, I want to give you an example of there's reasons why certain things are done in police and fire in the 25 years versus 30 years, I think is another recognition, not only of the type of workforce you want, or at that time, the goal of the legislature was as far as the type of workforce, but also their recognition that their lifespan is shorter than general service.
Brian?
Yeah.
Under the full formula calculation, the point or the 2.0 for police and fire, was that added in 81? And what happened, what was it like before that? Were they just general service?
Anybody know?
No,
yeah. Yeah.
Always been a little higher, but in 1981 they moved them to 2.0.
Mm-hmm. Okay. For the record, I'll say I don't know, and we'll try and get the information from the people that do know in the room. But. We're looking at the sheet right now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative King.
I've been thinking about asking it, but my memory is that it seems to be that it was mid to late 70s that there was a ballot measure where the public voted, statewide to enhance the benefit for police and fire. And I'm a little fuzzy on that, but it seems like that the legislature put that item on the ballot, and that the public voted, that enhanced benefit.
Yeah. Representative King, Mr. Chair, Representative King, if you look at your chart, and I'd have to study this a little bit more, it looks like there's a couple of different timelines here. 1970, pension factors increased, police and fire is 1.15. Then if you go to 73, it goes to 1.35. At 75, it was 1.35. So I think, and then full formula, it looked like, let's see, that chart goes down. Where's the arrow go down? Looks like it goes down at 81. So there was a dynamic that happened between that time period. I apologize. I didn't represent police and fire at that point. It's only been, over the last 6 or 7 years that I've had that. So I don't have that specific history in that area. So let me try and just give you a couple more things to think about. Let me shift to nurses. I'm well aware in the recent research that we've done inside the Oregon Nurses Association that there is a pretty dramatic disparity in salary compensation of registered nurses between county health departments and acute care facilities. And if you look at the competition that's going on with the shortage of nurses, but it's competition even when there's not a shortage of nurses for that particular workforce. County health departments are having a hell of a time right now trying to recruit somebody to come in. And so if you, again, just look at the salary piece, there's no way, I guess I would say, as if I were a nurse, that I would go to work in a county health department if your compensation is between 20% and 30% lower, and that's the figures that we've seen internally, is between 20% and 30% lower than the acute care. So again, I guess I would encourage you from that perspective to look at the PERS system as a part of the total compensation. We do hear routinely, not only with the Oregon Health Science University, because they are covered by PERS, but also when we have discussions with our nurses and county health departments, and they bitch and moan, and I'll say it straight out, about their salary versus somebody who works in the hospital down the road. And when you have a whole discussion about, okay, what's your total compensation, including your retirement package at the end going to look like, the response that they have is, we're still short of everybody else, but because of the PERS system, we're going to stay in this, we're going to stay here, we're going to work here. That's something that retains those folks in that system. So again, I would encourage you to look at the whole piece. Let me transition into a couple of final. You know, you've heard about the past. Let me bring a couple of additional factors to the table. Taxation of PERS benefits. You've heard about it before, but that made a pretty dramatic difference in the rates that employers paid. That wasn't something that we thought was a good idea. That's something that the legislature thought was a good idea because of the litigation on the federal employees. And who derived the benefit from that? Well, the employees didn't. It just increased the benefits to compensate for the taxation. So we basically, it was a wash. In fact, it's not quite a wash for the employees. Who benefited? The state did, because it increased your tax revenues. And who didn't benefit or was hurt pretty substantially? And it was the employers. And we agree that that was probably, while politically, the move that the legislature made, not a wise move to make at that time, and would still point back to that time period as saying that was not the right move to make. And it did cost the employers, and ultimately, of course, their rates went up because of that. You heard a little bit about pooling. We continue to encourage pooling. I know there's a lot of discussion about the difference between mandatory pooling and voluntary pooling. We think, and we've had a lot of discussions in the PERS Coalition, that mandatory pooling of the non-state and school districts who are already pooled makes sense for stability and rates. Whether politically that can be done or not, you know, that's a discussion between local employers. Some want it, some don't want it. That's where we're at now. Bonding of the unfunded liability, I think we finally got there, but the point I wanted to bring up with that, along with the employer and the variable, was those were all decisions the legislature could have made and actually were laid at your doorstep, not all of you were here, but have been laid at your doorstep at various times over the last 10 years. And for various reasons, you did or did not do some of these things at that point. Unfortunately, all these things were bundled along with the third tier. And from the employee side, at 8 years ago, 6 years ago, or 10 years ago, we could not accept the third tier. But at the same time, we agreed that about 85% of the things that were in those bills, including pooling, bonding, employer, and the variable, were the right thing to do and should have been done from the perspective of helping the system. And the reason why I bring this up is to kind of lay bare that if there's this speculation or picture that the system is somehow going sour because no one was aware of some of the problems, we've been aware of the problems for 8 to 10 years. And the legislature didn't act on some of the things individually that could have helped solve those problems. So that's kind of the history. Now, where do we go from here? I said it in our first work group meeting that what's my goal? Well, I think we need to end the litigation. I think we need, as a group, what I would like to see is some way in which we can not only review the current system, but if we look at new replacement systems or whatever, and I'm sure that's where part of the discussion will go, but we figure out a way that the PERS board, and you've heard it from their executive director, has a very clear path as to what the legislature means, what the law means, and that the litigation can stop in the future. It's not good for us to be spending our resources in litigation and the employers the same way, and it also stalls a lot of the potential fixes that could be done. With that, one example, obviously, is for the future is, but it's also a fix that we felt could have been accomplished or should have been accomplished, is the upgrade of the mortality tables. Obviously, you know, we talked about that during the third special session. We have our view. The employers have a different view. But I think, unfortunately, we've got ourselves into this litigation pattern, and that's unfortunate. And that would be, again, one of my goals in the work group. With that, I'll end my comments. I know I've kind of touched on a number of subjects, but I kind of wanted to take us from the history to some of the decisions the legislature did or didn't make that have impacted the system, and then kind of say, okay, where do we go from here?
Yeah, Brian, as it relates to the taxation issue, that was that House Bill 3349?
They all go together, but I'm going to say yes. I was going to say 3049, but I think it was 3349.
Yeah, and that was in the 97 session. And that did add to the unfunded liability, that's my understanding.
Yeah.
So maybe the employers will talk about that. I know they broached the subject when I went and talked to the county folks. So maybe they'll talk about it today. But I think that was a significant policy decision that, you know, obviously added to the problem.
I would agree.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two items. First of all, I wanted to touch base on the 3349 and the taxation, and then refer to another portion of Brian's presentation. Brian, is there any way to unwind 3349? Is there a simple way to go back and unring that bell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think you'd need somebody a little smarter than me to figure that out. But I think maybe there is some people that are smart enough to give you a direct answer, and I don't know. Once you
hold on
once
a second, Bob, do you want to go ahead? Did you want to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I was just going to look behind me to my right, and I think there's probably several people that would jump at maybe being able to help you with that particular question.
Oh, I was just looking for somebody smarter than him.
Well, yeah. I better look elsewhere, Mr. Chair.
I guess the issue that I'm not familiar enough with, Representative Butler, is the dynamic that creates then again with the federal employees, that whole legal issue that started us down this path. How do you resolve that, resolve the taxation issue, and not get us into a bind with the difference between, you know, people being handled different ways? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just hoping that they had an easy answer, that amongst the folks that Brian represents, there was an easy answer. I would like to go back to another portion of your testimony, and that relates to our public health nurses. I'm very concerned about that. I understand that we're short in this nation in excess of 130,000 nurses at present, and I think that legislatively we could probably attempt to address some of that issue to try and bring Oregon's health and science folks and other teaching universities within the state up to speed to try and help us bring the maximum numbers of nurses online. That having been said, I am concerned as to the status of our public health nurses, and I'm just wondering, in as much as you represent those folks, it's probably the best. You're the best to whom to be discussing, or with whom to be discussing this issue. The concern I've got is there some perception that it's better to work in an emergency hospital and emergency medicine, or perhaps go out to work in our correction system and the state prisons or other institutions than it would be to work in a public health situation? Are there some relative benefits there, Brian?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'll give you what my feeling is, and then I'm going to go back to our staff because we have done a number of surveys of all of our members based upon their employment setting and ask questions about their employment, and I may be able to find some information there. I guess my first comment would be that if you're a fresh-faced graduate of a nursing program, there probably is some immediate incentive to go to work for somebody who's going to pay you 30% more than some other employer. So I think while it may be somewhat short-sighted if you don't look at your full career and your full benefits and everything else and your retirement benefits, I think that's one of the, obviously, the dynamics. With that said, there is another slight difference between the public health system and a nurse going to work in an acute care setting or in a corrections facility or any other place. A nurse is not a nurse is not a nurse. I mean, they really do specialize. And so what you find going into the public health service, county health departments, is really a different animal than what you find going to work in an acute care setting. But they make that decision at some point in their both education and their early employment history. And for what reason do they make that decision? Well, again, it probably has to do with compensation. It may be based upon some history that they have, family history or interests. You know, some people go into geriatric nursing because they've got an interest because they had an aunt who was had Alzheimer's and they like working with that population. So there's a lot of factors, but I think the salary probably for someone who doesn't have all these other factors feeding into it probably is the first enticement to go here rather than to go there. And in many cases, we have to convince them that Coos County or Curry County or Harney County is the right place to go to work. But there are some other things that we're also working on unrelated to PERS.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can comment, Mary Boskin again with AFSCME. We represent about 4,000 employees at OHSU, and we have virtually everybody up there but the nurses and the doctors. OHSU provides a career opportunity that few medical facilities in Oregon provide, and that is kind of the cutting edge of medical practices. And so if you look at folks who go to work at OHSU and who stay there, those are the folks who really are involved in some of the new medical procedures and some of the newest technology. There was a time where if you wanted to be on a transplant team, you went to work at OHSU, and that's where you trained. And you trained under people like Albert Starr. You know, you trained in an environment which provides services to the sickest of the sick and the worst of the worst cases. And so, you know, for a lot of people, that is where you go if you are interested in a medical career. Prisons are probably one of the hardest places that we have to recruit. We also represent about 2,500 employees in the prison system, and one of our biggest challenges is recruitment and retention of nurses. And Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, you know what a difficult time we have at Snake River of keeping a nursing staff, a qualified nursing staff employed in some of our more rural facilities, and whether or not they want to go to work at, what's the hospital?
Holy Rosary.
Holy Rosary or the prison. I'm just thinking, do I really want to work with bad guys every day, or do I just want to work with sick people? It takes a special person to go into a prison and work with sick people who really want to hurt you or take your drugs.
Mr. Chair, both Ms. Botkin and Mr. Delashman have brought up the issue of OHSU. I'd like to know, I understand that the employees at OHSU also have an optional retirement program outside of the PERS, and it's my understanding that more of them are now opting away from the PERS system. PERS still has the majority of the employees. What can you tell me about that trend to opt away from the existing state PERS system and into their private system?
I cannot comment readily. I can tell you that for our lower classifications, for folks who, and that just sounds like a derogatory term, and I certainly don't mean it that way, because somebody has to clean the operating rooms. But for those folks who do not have readily transferable skills in the medical profession, as their union, we would always encourage them to stay in PERS. For folks who are looking at OHSU as a short-term learning possibility, with transferable skills into other alternative other medical facilities, those individuals would be more inclined to go into the alternative plan, because the alternative plan is not designed for the career employee. It is designed for the short-term professor, doctor, traveling medical experts who come in for a few years and then leave. It is much more transferable. As PERS, as the rhetoric around PERS escalates, people's confidence in the system become a little shaky, and so there may be a move. I don't have any evidence to indicate that, and I don't know whether Brian does or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think Mary's probably right as far as the stability in certain classifications of them staying in the PERS system or opting to stay in the PERS system. When the alternative plan was first brought forward as an option and approved, when they went independent, say the word independent, they still derive obviously some pretty substantial state revenues or resources. We did not encourage our folks in the nursing profession to opt into the other alternative system. And I believe a overwhelming majority of our folks, both those that were in the system, PERS system, and all the new employees that have come in as nurses, have opted to stay in the PERS system. And I think it's the dynamic of, as Mary indicated, the career folks. Keep in mind that nurses have extremely high mobility. I mean, right now they can find a job anywhere, and people are paying bounties to get them to work other places. Mm-hmm. And what you have is a stabilizing factor by them being in the PERS system, both with the Hill and with the county health department.
I just have to tell you a real-life story, which is a friend of mine's daughter just graduated from the University of Portland, summa cum laude in nursing, and she was actively recruited by every hospital in the city of Portland and surrounding states. OHSU was certainly in the bidding war for her services. She could have gone to work anywhere she wanted to go. She chose to go into the private sector because the wage package was so much superior to anything in the public sector that she could have realized, that she just felt like, and she is, by the way, 22 years old.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think that perhaps someone from the OHSU should be invited to just either share some information about their system, for it is a system which has been within the state confines, set up separately. My recollection is that some of the information about new employees and the those employees who may not be the professional line of employees is probably correct, but there's some indication that, and it may be because of the rhetoric and the difficulties which surround the existing PERS funding and overall financial credibility right now of the system, but I think it would be important for us to know what kind of a retirement opportunity that the private system has, and quasi-private public, I guess, anything we can do to find out more about those kinds of systems, I think would be beneficial to the committee.
Let's make a note for our next meeting. Probably already been done.
Yeah.
Great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I'm going to keep my comments very brief, Mr. Chair. I know that there's plenty of other people that want the opportunity to speak. However, having said that, as one of the members of the PERS Coalition, I'm one of the few people that is actually a member of the system. I am a firefighter here in Salem, and just if I could, just for a moment, I'd like to maybe give you some insight on somebody, firsthand experience of somebody that does benefit from the PERS system. And one of the things that I'd like to maybe share with you is just a brief kind of analysis of, I grew up in the Southern Oregon area. I've worked in the timber industry. I've done a lot of those things. Currently, my brother, who's in the private sector, is a superintendent of a sawmill in Douglas County, and certainly as a private employee, he has many opportunities that certainly I don't, and certainly we all make choices with respect to careers and what we elect to do. However, having said that, particularly for many of our public servants, as an example, their sawmill has been maybe a little bit of an anomaly, and they've done fairly well this year, and timber prices have held steady, and they've upgraded their mill to make it where it is very efficient and is ran very well. One of the examples that I give to many of my firefighters is that currently his owner, and he's a good owner that he works for, acknowledged the hard work that they put in and said, Bill, you guys have done a great job. I want you to plan a trip for anywhere for a week's time and take your foreman and let me know what the price is and go and do those things. Certainly those are perks that are available to many people in high levels, administrative positions of various companies and whatnot. And I guess the analogy that I'm trying to make is that we all make choices, and many of the people that I represent have made a choice to be a public servant and not necessarily a career as a firefighter, because it's much more of a lifestyle as a firefighter because of the hours that you work, the schedules that you work, the family and the relationships that you make as a firefighter, living in those. And so I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that as we evaluate this system and try to come up with what is an appropriate benefit, I think that we need to look in this and keep this in perspective, that for many public servants, some of the options that are available out there to the private citizens and the private sector are simply not there. However, having said that, the one thing that is there and that is in my mind, as I have made a lifestyle choice that I have and that many firefighters have in front of me and that will continue to do so, is one of the things that they know and realize is that they will have a good retirement at the end of a long career and lifestyle as a public servant. And I think one of the things that we need to keep in perspective is just that perspective of there is trade-offs in everything that we do. And one of the things that currently concerns me, and I hear it around the fire stations, is, as you know, realistically, everybody says we have two tiers. Well, I would say already we already have three tiers because of some of the retirement options that are not available to everybody that's in PERS right now. And so one of the things I think that we really need to do, and Mr. Chair, I apologize for being late, and maybe you touched on this, or Mr. Voitko touched on this prior to my arrival, is that I think we really truly do need to take an analysis of some of the effects that, one, some of the changes that we've already made, some of the changes that the board is currently looking at making, and the fact that I think we need to do a good analysis of Tier 2. I really don't think we've done that. And one of the fears that I have is that I think the legislative body and the employers and the employee groups have realized that retirement is probably one of the most important benefits and one of the most difficult things to try to muster and to try to configure out what type of plan is appropriate. one of the things that concerns me is that, and I've mentioned that, is that over the, if we take just a snapshot and look over the last few years, particularly at the stock market, I think most of us, you know, have the tendency to, I personally have almost panicked a few times with some of my deals, but having said that, as you noted yourself, Mr. Chair, as long as you haven't moved your money around, you don't necessarily have lost the money. And what I guess I'm trying to portray to this committee is that we need to look at long-term as well as short-term goals of a retirement system and keep in mind that what is happening right now is just a snapshot of a system that is designed for a 25 to a 30-year career of an employee and a 25 to 30-year target of the stock market as well as an investing strategy from the Oregon Investment Council. And so with that, the only other thing that I would request that we also look at is that certainly PERS is very important to many Oregonians, and I would like to see, and maybe it's already been broached, what are the benefits and how has PERS impacted some of the economic benefits of Oregon in the economy? And I think that we will find that there has been many good things that have happened. And as examples, people that generally have a reasonable retirement typically are not the ones that have to fall into those safety net programs that we are also funding currently, also stimulating the economy in other ways, I think, through investments is something that we need to take a look at. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just echo some of the same thoughts that some of my previous members have said, and that's just that I hope that we can look at this in a holistic way, make good, sound policy decisions, and certainly base those decisions on what's right, not only for employees, but also for employers and certainly for the citizens of Oregon. And with that, I would close my testimony and look forward to this process as we encroach on a difficult and sometimes very controversial subject. Thank you.
Thank you for your participation. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I just asked Mr. Livingston, what's the status of the firefighters on federal fires, those federal firefighters, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Reclamation, do they have similar early retirement programs for federal firefighters?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe that they many of the federal firefighters are part-time, summertime help. As far as the ones that are doing it year long and are considered permanent employees, I believe they fall under some type of federal government retirement, but I don't know specifically whether they're eligible for early retirement or not.
Bob, if you have anybody who you think ought to testify on your particular request as it relates to economics and the PERS system and so on, we'd be happy to, you know, entertain that possibility.
I'll do some
specific names. So if you think about it and get back to us, that'd be great.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? We'll just keep moving.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association and also the PERS Coalition. I want to thank you very much for allowing me to participate in this work group. I won't repeat testimony. I think Mr. DeLashmet gave very fine examples of educators that work hard and how compensation packages overall need to be considered, and PERS is just one aspect of that. I would echo Mr. Livingston's request for more analysis of Tier 2. I think it's important as we move forward that we make sure that we haven't already fixed it and it just hasn't, we just haven't reaped the benefits yet. It takes time for people to become a part of the process and then also to retire and see how that affects. Tier 2 people haven't even begun to retire yet, so we don't know yet whether we still have a problem. It could be that we have handled part of that already, and I would just urge further consideration and analysis of Tier 2 and how it relates to Tier 1. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions on behalf of education if I can.
Thank you. Any questions? I know we're doing, but the PERS folks are doing an analysis of Tier 1 and Tier 2 separately.
Great.
And that might be available sometime this fall. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Other questions? Anybody else who wants to testify on behalf of the employees? We'll take a 10-minute break. I didn't know what to call this for sure, but some folks want to take a break and, you know, maybe get some caffeine or something like that. So we'll go ahead and take a 10-minute break, but let's start promptly at 10:45. We're in recess.